This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with human rights attorney Reed Brody, who's just written a wonderful book called To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hossein Habré.
It's an example of how determined lawyers and courageous victims can fight back and win. We hear from Norman Solomon, an expert on media matters, and how the media has an impact on the elections in the United States.
Norman Solomon literally wrote the book on this matter. Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Human rights attorney Reed Brody's page-turning book, To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hossein Habré, is being published this month, November 2022, by Columbia University Press. Habré was the dictator of Chad, a landlocked country in Central Africa, from 1982 to 1990. He was deposed by a coup and exiled to nearby Senegal. Attorney Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch led a coalition of human rights activists, lawyers, and victims, which brought Habré to justice. The lead attorney lawyer for the victims was African attorney Jacqueline Mudina. Habré was found guilty in a courtroom in Dakar, Senegal, in May of 2016, of rape, sexual slavery, torture, and the killing of over 40,000 citizens of Chad. He was the first former head of state to be convicted of crimes against humanity in the courts of another country. We speak today with Reed Brody, who worked for 18 years with Human Rights Watch alongside Hossein Habré's victims. Reed Brody has helped pursue dictators Augusto Pinochet of Chile, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier of Haiti, and Yahya Jammeh of Ghana. He also uncovered atrocities of U.S.-backed Contras in Nicaragua, led U.N. missions in El Salvador, in the Congo, and exposed the Bush administration's torture. Attorney Reed Brody, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Reed, who is the dictator we're talking about, Hossein Habré? What did he do, and why do you call him the African Pinochet?
So Hossein Habré was the dictator of Chad from 1982 to 1990. He was put into power, as we'll certainly talk about, by Ronald Reagan in the first covert operation of the Ronald Reagan period, before the Jonas Savimbi in Angola, before the Contras in Nicaragua. And he's accused, in fact, been convicted of thousands of political killings, of systematic torture between 1982 and 1990. I call him the African Pinochet because at the time that we began the case, Augusto Pinochet had been arrested in London on a warrant from a Spanish judge. That was the beginning of really the era of universal jurisdiction and international justice. And we want, I think both Pinochet and Hossein Habré would be very insulted to be compared to each other, very different people. Pinochet, a Catholic, strong defender of religion and conservatism. Hossein Habré, actually, background as a desert warlord spouting Mao and Che Guevara. Hossein Habré was living in exile in Senegal. And when I was working on the Pinochet case in London with Michael Ratner and many others, and when the House of Lords said that Augusto Pinochet could be arrested anywhere in the world, despite his status as a former head of state, we realized that we had a new tool to bring to justice people who seemed out of the reach of justice. And we were approached by Chadians who said, well, we have somebody who did worse things than Pinochet, and he's now living in Senegal. And so when we brought the case against Habré, we wanted to really emphasize that we were kind of pulling a Pinochet. We were doing the same thing. We were using the principle of universal jurisdiction. Just the way Pinochet from Chile could be arrested in London, Hissène Habré of Chad could be arrested in Senegal, and that is what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, Reed, you know, it took you and your team 18 years, a heroic 18 years, I would add, to bring this monster really to justice. Why did it take so long?
Well, it at first it looked like it was going to go very well. We put together teams in both Chad and Senegal. We sent investigators to Chad to work with the victims, to prepare a dossier. And in this really a surprise operation, we brought the Chadians to Senegal, the victims, and we filed the case before an investigating judge. And within a couple of weeks, the investigating judge had arrested Hissène Habré and put him under house arrest and indicted him on torture charges. And it seemed like it was going to go well. And then really politics entered the picture. We had timed the complaint for electoral season because we figured this would be the president of Chad at the time would not want to be seen defending a dictator. But the new president who came in really put the kibosh on everything. And he brought in Habré's lawyer as his main legal advisor, and he basically had the case thrown out. It took us another 15 years to get back to court. We filed the case first in Belgium under Belgium's long-arm universal jurisdiction law. A Belgian judge began to investigate the case, spent 4 years, in fact, went to Chad, conducted a mission, prepared the case. But as you may remember, the Belgian law on universal jurisdiction, which at the time, together with the Spanish law, was the widest in the world, it was great when it was being used against people from Rwanda or others. But when there were cases filed in Belgium, first against Ariel Sharon of Israel, and then against George Bush's father for alleged war crimes in the first Gulf War, Donald Rumsfeld, U.S. Secretary of Defense, came to Belgium. I was there. And he said, if NATO leaders cannot come to Belgium without fear of being arrested, then maybe we'll have to move NATO out of Belgium. And the law collapsed like a house of cards. But then, as the law was collapsing, we brought the Chadian victims. We brought victims from around the world to Belgium to plead their case. And this is, to me, one of the great lessons of the Habré case, was how victims are their own best advocates. Because the hero of this story, who maybe we'll talk about, Suleiman Genge, who was a prisoner of Habré's and came out and began the fight for justice, we went to Belgium. He looked the politicians in the eye. We met the Minister of Justice, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And he said, you know, I came out of jail. I promised, as people were dying around me, that I was going to fight for justice if I ever got out. We went to Senegal. Senegal betrayed us. We came to Belgium. We felt that you had sent us a lifeline. You sent us a judge. You began investigating the case. We really believed in you. And now you're telling me because of Donald Rumsfeld, I can't get justice? And the Belgian, no, Mr. Gengeng, no, Mr. Gengeng, we'll figure out a way. And so actually, as the law, Belgian law was collapsed under the weight of double standards and Donald Rumsfeld, a grandfather clause was put in to save our case. And Belgium continued, indicted Hissène Habré, requested Habré's extradition from Senegal. Senegal then hemmed and hawed, referred the case to the African Union. The African Union sent the case back, said, Senegal, you have to prosecute. Senegal said, we will, but then they didn't. And then we got Belgium. Because of the work that Suleiman had done in Belgium, we created a real reservoir of support. And Belgium took the case. They took Senegal to the International Court of Justice. And in a 15-0 decision, the International Court of Justice said to Senegal, you have to prosecute Hissène Habré without further delay or extradite him. And then by that time, a new president was in power in Senegal, actually just a month before that decision, a president who Suleiman and the other victims and I had met and who promised to do justice. And within 2 years, the court was set up and Hissène Habré was on trial. But it took a very long time.
Just to be clear here, Reed, can you explain in a couple of sentences just what the principle of universal jurisdiction is?
So universal jurisdiction is the principle of international law, that some crimes are so heinous that the courts of any country can prosecute those crimes sort of as a court standing in for humanity. And that was the principle under which Adolf Eichmann was tried in Israel, although his crimes predated even the existence of the State of Israel. It was the principle that was used to prosecute pirates in the old days and then torturers. And it's international law's answer to the spectacle of tyrants and torturers who cover themselves with immunity at home. And it prevents them from getting a safe haven in another country. And now, actually, there are many trials. There was recently, last week, a trial in France of a Liberian warlord. We saw who was in France and was convicted. We saw a few months ago Syrian intelligence agents who were prosecuted and convicted in Germany. So it's a principle of international law that is being used more and more in our globalized world. Habré is the only case ever of a head of state being prosecuted under the principle of universal jurisdiction.
I wonder, Reed, is there perhaps a favorite, or short, given our time constraints, part of your book which you would care to read for our listeners?
You know, I'll go with actually the very opening of the book, which is in Chad under Habré in 1989. And the book begins, "Kam Matu." Abu Musa, the prison warden, was yelling into the cell in Chadian Arabic as he did each morning. "How many are dead?" "Three," one of the prisoners answered feebly. "Not yet," replied Musa. "I'll take away the corpses when there are five." Suleiman Gengeng, lying in the cell in the prison at the gendarmerie of the Chadian capital, had seen dozens of other prisoners die already, and he feared he might be next. He had contracted dengue fever and malaria and could hardly stand. Their large cell here was almost completely sealed off, with no natural light coming in and temperatures routinely reaching 110 degrees. The stench of human waste and decomposing bodies was unbearable. To keep his mind alive, he murmured Christian songs to himself. "I am not afraid. God is with me. A divine promise supports my faith." And then I end the chapter by saying, Suleiman endured, but he also took an oath before God that if he ever got out of prison alive, he would spend the rest of his days fighting to bring his oppressors to justice.
Reed Brody, you're an international law attorney. Jim Laffey and I are both attorneys. We're here at Law and Disorder. We wanted to ask you, Reed, the International Criminal Court has been set up, but has only secured three final convictions, and those have been of rebel warlords, not heads of state. It's spent $1.7 billion in the past. How does that compare to the court that was set up and successfully handled the Habré case, the Extraordinary African Chambers?
Well, that's a great question. You're absolutely right. In 20 years, the ICC has only convicted rebels. Not one state official at any level anywhere in the world. At the same time, I think the existence of the ICC has been incredibly important, both because of the norms that it sets forth, many of which have been transposed into international law, because it represents a global commitment, uneven, of course, to the idea of fighting impunity. And also because it sits as a weight on a lot of the ICC is on the tail of a lot of countries pushing them. And we have seen in the last 20 years a huge amount of justice around the world. We've seen heads of state in countries, but this has all been done at the national and what the so-called hybrid level. So you've seen in Latin America, Fujimori prosecuted for human rights crimes in Peru, Rios Montt for genocide in Guatemala, Charles Taylor by the special court for Sierra Leone. Even in the Habre case, I don't think we would have been able to do it without the ICC. Why? Because the African Union wanted to get the ICC off its backs. The first 29 indictments from the ICC were of Africans, and the African Union wanted to show to the ICC that it could prosecute its own people. And so, as I told earlier, the African Union sent the case back to Senegal and ultimately formed a hybrid court with Senegal, a court that was invested with the authority both of Senegal and the African Union, had judges mostly from Senegal but also from the African Union. It only cost $10 million, a lot of money to you and me, but compared to the billion, to the $2 billion at the ICC or the $1 billion at the war crimes tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, just really a drop in the bucket. A lot of that, of course, is because the victims, over 20 years, over the 16 years that we were preparing the trial, we also prepared evidence. We found thousands of documents of Habre's political police with Habre's handwriting on it, lists of people who died in jail. We really were able to hand the case to the court effectively on a silver platter.
Reed, thank you for that. But you know, Reed, also, it seems that it's a fair criticism, really, to say that the only people that are brought to justice are from, well, weak, non-Western countries. It seems almost impossible to bring war criminals like Henry Kissinger or Donald Rumsfeld or George Bush to justice. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think that's an absolutely fair criticism. I mean, as Michael Smith knows, Michael Ratner and I tried to bring Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush to book. We filed cases in France, in Germany, in Spain. Each time, politics trumped the law. I mean, I think we're seeing even in Ukraine. I don't think, you know, I mean, there's been a vast mobilization, maybe we'll talk about that, around crimes in Ukraine. But, you know, the international justice system does not have a police force. The United States has refused to join the ICC. The United States is very happy and has been very constructive in the Habre case and in many others for justice for others. But there are zones of impunity. The countries on the Security Council, China, Russia, the United States, countries that they protect, Israel, Syria, North Korea. It's very difficult to, as you say, there's been very little or no justice against powerful actors. And I think that's a major flaw, obviously, in not just, it's not so much in the international justice system, in the international political system.
We're talking with human rights attorney Reed Brody. Columbia University Press has just published his wonderful book, To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hussein Habre. Why do you write that the United States and France played a pivotal role in supporting Habre?
So, you know, the Chad, I mean, you have to see where Chad is. It's in a very, what they call a very dangerous neighborhood. It's between Libya and Sudan and Central African Republic. And at the time when Ronald Reagan took power, Libya was, in fact, Libya of Muammar Gaddafi fame, was actually occupying the north of Chad. And Reagan called Gaddafi the mad dog of the Middle East, and he was determined to stop Gaddafi. And the U.S. identified Libyan troops in Chad as a vulnerability. And Alexander Haig according to Bob Woodward, he said, we're going to use Hissin Habre to bloody Gaddafi's nose. And the U.S., at the time, Hissin Habre was a desert warlord. He became prime minister. He then broke with the president. A huge civil war broke out in which Habre's troops were committed massive atrocities. This is before he became president. But the U.S. did not care. They saw him as the anti-Gaddafi. And so the U.S., first covert operation, brings Hissin Habre into power. Then the France is kind of brought along. Then France in particular, but also the U.S., then support him in a war in which he defeats Gaddafi. And when he defeats Gaddafi, he gets a state invitation to the White House. As you said, he's received with honors. He was also a special guest at the July 14th celebration in France. He was the toast of the town. As the U.S. ambassador said, he came to America and he had delivered Gaddafi's head on a silver platter. 20 years later, we get Habre convicted. And the U.S. supported, you know, I have to say, under the Obama administration, the U.S. supported us. And we got support from, despite the fact that, you know, this would bring up, you know, U.S. crimes of the past. John Kerry made a statement that this conviction would be a good opportunity to reflect on, you know, the U.S.'s role in bringing in Habre's era. Obviously, the U.S. has not done so. Right as we speak, there's another dictator in Chad. Not as bloody as Hissin Habre, but 50 people were killed the other day and demonstrations were gunned down. And the U.S. still supports the Chadian government as an island of stability, this time against jihadists who have taken over much of the region.
Now, Reed Brody, you dedicate your fine book to Michael Ratner and to your son, Zach, and Habre's victims. Your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, Michael was my hero, my mentor, my co-teacher, my friend. And throughout the book, I mean, the book is a very action-oriented, character-driven, kind of tries to be a thriller. But the moments of reflection in the book are moments where I'm talking to Michael. Michael had did not believe particularly in the law. Michael believed that you use the law, you use courts to expose in American policy, to expose oppression. I was always kind of laser focused on the bottom line: are we going to win? And that for Michael was not the issue. And so we go back and forth. I mean, I learned a lot from Mike. Every time we talk, as we did today, about Hissin Habre, I make sure to talk about how he was put in power by the U.S., how he was supported by the West, how double standards operate, it's great to get justice for an African dictator, but you need to look at the larger questions.
Reed, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time. Can you tell us briefly what you're working on now and how people can follow your work?
So now I work as an independent war crimes prosecutor, helping others who are looking to do this. And I'm particularly working these days with the victims of the former president of Gambia, Yahya Jammeh, who's in exile in Equatorial Guinea. I work closely with the Bar Association with Gambian victims. People can follow my work on Twitter, maybe not so much longer, in the news, I guess.
Let's just mention your book again, Reed, To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissin Habre, a great book, a real page-turner. I read it. It was a thriller. Thank you, Reed. Thank you for your good work. Thank you for your book. And thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
I was very happy to be on this show. I love your show. Take care, guys.
We'll see you at the book launch, Reed. Take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a...
Virtually everyone agrees that the mainstream corporate media in the United States plays a major role in who wins our elections, although there's great disagreement about who benefits from the role that they play. Many on the right, of course, simply characterize the media as the liberal media, the big lying media, as Trump likes to call it, and give it little credence. While on the left, most argue that since the mainstream media is corporate, it operates for the benefit of those candidates most likely to advance the interest of corporate America, and, of course, both parties do that. So today we examine the role played by the mainstream media in our elections. How truthful is its election reporting? What role does social media play in the electoral process? If indeed the mainstream media plays a role in our elections, is it in fact a decisive role? And if it is, how does it do that? Well, if you stay tuned, I truly believe you're going to be surprised by some of what you learned today. I say that because today we've got the perfect guest to help us to examine this topic in all of its permutations. He is Norman Solomon, certainly one of America's true champions of a free and an honest press. Mr. Solomon is a longtime associate of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, which has proven to be a powerful watchdog on the American media. Norman Solomon is co-founder of the online activist organization RootsAction.org, and he's also the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He is, of course, the author of too many articles to recite here, as well as a number of books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Also the book Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. Norman Solomon, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hey, thanks very much.
And Norman, today's mainstream media, it's largely corporately owned by giant corporations whose, well, principal work product was not always journalism. Who are these giant companies? Do they effectively constitute a monopoly? Is there a significant difference between print and TV and radio media in this regard?
Well, the media ownership has really consolidated in the last few decades. These companies are larger in size and fewer in number as they dominate. So Ben Bagdikian, the former managing editor of the Washington Post, who wrote a number of editions of his book, The Media Monopoly, if we went back 30 years, he was writing that we had 50 corporations through ownership controlling most of the news and information flow in the United States. That's 50. Mm-hmm. By the beginning of this century, the number was down to 6 controlling through ownership most of the media flow in this country. Now we have 6 corporations controlling 90% of the media reach in the United States. What are these outlets? What are their names? Well, they're somewhat familiar to us, although we might not realize just the extent of their media ownership. Let's start with Comcast, which owns NBC and MSNBC, Hulu. It owns Universal Pictures and Telemundo, and also millions of us are contracted with Comcast to get our internet hookup and Wi-Fi and all that. So Comcast is a giant. Another one is Walt Disney. It owns ABC, ESPN. It owns Touchstone Pictures. What about AT&T? Well, they own CNN, HBO, Warner Brothers, Turner Broadcasting, and we shouldn't leave out Fox, owned by the Murdoch, the very right-wing
Murdoch Family News Corp. And I know Fox has a lot of incarnations in terms of television and online presence and so forth. New York Times, the so-called liberal media, but basically centrist corporate. We have Jeff Bezos, who, of course, got incredibly wealthy, a multi-billionaire, very early through his ownership and development of Amazon. Now he owns the Washington Post, along with Whole Foods, and they're getting into healthcare. And a couple more to mention. Gannett is huge, owns USA Today, and then Tribune Media Company. So this is really a virtual to directly answer that question. It's very close to an all-out monopoly going on.
Norman, in terms of its impact on the outcome of an election, does it matter what election stories the media decides to carry or where to place the story in their reporting?
It matters what the stories are, where they're placed, what the tone is, who the sources are, what the headlines are. And it's also a very common reality that there's a percolation between the internet, between so-called legacy media. You know, there's a lot of hype about how, now the internet has opened things up. Well, the internet, yes, it gives people a chance to set up their own website and communicate via email and social media. But the fact is that the same major media outlets, whether it's the New York Times or CNN or Fox News, that dominates the traditional media outlets, they also dominate what is online, what people are getting on the web and so forth. And all of that in aggregate, what is put in, what is left out, how candidates are portrayed, all that certainly doesn't determine definitely who wins an election, but it has a huge effect.
You know, Norman, some media giants, such as Fox, openly and rather proudly, I would say, demonstrate their, well, pro-right-wing, pro-Republican Party and corporate biases. They operate more or less as the propaganda arm of the right. But I would argue that CBS, NBC, CNN, as well as most of the print media in America, also have deep biases. They simply foul them in less open ways than does Fox and other similar media outlets. Am I correct?
Well, there's a myth that we have this neutrality, this so-called centrism or objectivity. The reality is that we have what could be called propaganda from the center. The fact that it is somewhere situated between the right wing and the left wing doesn't change the fact that there are biases, biases for corporate power, what's put in, what's left out, biases assuming the good intentions, even if there are occasional screw-ups, of U.S. foreign and military policy. And I give you just one example, not only the overtly covert way in which corporate ownership is very clearly a commercial enterprise, but let's talk about National Public Radio. It has a program called Marketplace. There's no program called Labor Place. And that has to do with the funding and orientation of NPR News and programs like All Things Considered and Morning Edition, which are now mass media. Each one of those programs reaches several million people every day. And Marketplace, not to pick on them, but that also reaches millions of people every day. Well, that's public radio. But the public is cut out of the orientation. Why don't we have a Labor Place program on National Public Radio? It's because working people and labor are not the vantage points through which reporting is generally provided. It is the owners, it is the investors, it is the concentrations of capital that are exalted. And so we have these supposedly heroic investors, such as Jeff Bezos. Well, the window on the world from corporate media and what gets called, unfortunately, public radio and public television, which usually is not, is a window from the vantage point of those of great wealth and investment power and corporations. So it's very unusual to have a program, even once in a while, that gives a window on the world from the vantage point of working people, of low-income people, of those who suffer from systemic injustice.
Yeah, in fact, I remember, Norman, many moons ago, You and I think Jeff Cohn and folks at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a study of the impact, for example, of underwriting from Archer Daniels Midland or what have you on public radio, and how it affected, I think you found how it affected who they had on and what kinds of stories they covered. Do you want to talk to us a bit about that as well?
Well, the Media Watch Group FAIR, which can be found online at fair.org, has been doing studies now for, several decades, and the funding is fascinating to line up next to the actual content. Who gets on the major TV shows? You know, you choose your sources and you choose your spin. And the reality is that the major media outlets, I'm talking the big broadcast networks, the big cable television and so forth, they have a guest list that is very establishment oriented, to put it mildly. And so spokespeople for corporations, for so-called think tanks that are funded by corporations and very wealthy people, entrenched politicians and office holders, these tend to dominate the discourse. And people who were affected by the policies that are handed down and implemented by the power structure, it's very difficult to get a lot of words in edgewise. How often, for instance, do we hear from poor people and what it's like to live on a low fixed income? How often do we hear from prisoners? We have 2 million people behind bars in this country, and yet, even if there's coverage of prisons, we hear about people, we don't hear from them. And that is another form of media bias.
For those who've just tuned in, I'm attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with Jim Lafferty, my former law partner. We're speaking with media expert Norman Solomon. Norman, much is made of the role that money plays in the outcome of elections in America. Rich candidates can afford far more media advertisement than the poorer ones. But does that bear some responsibility? Does the media have some responsibility for the role advertising plays in our elections? And it cannot, for example, refuse to carry a candidate's ad or carry it, but place it in a less advantageous spot the candidate would not prefer. What do you think about where they place things in the role of money?
It's very unusual for a media outlet to decline to run an ad. The money is just so attractive, and especially during election years, it's a huge amount that comes to TV and radio, even some print outlets as well. So unless it's just a complete flagrant lie, and even then it's a toss-up, the advertising will come on through, and huge amounts of money. And generally, the candidates who have more money will win because of advertising capacity. I think it's important, though, for us not to be too defeatist about this. We should be realistic, but we should also realize that, so to speak, the power of the people from the bottom can really topple those who are trying to impose their will from the top. For instance, we've just gotten the results in Los Angeles in the mayor's race. And
yes,
even though you have this fellow named Caruso who put in an astonishing amount of money, he's a billionaire, and he spent $100 million to try to buy the office of the mayor of Los Angeles. And he came very close, but he lost. And I think that's a sort of a parable for what we're up against, but what also we can overcome.
Yeah, and he lost on door-to-door, old-fashioned, knocking on doors, talking to people, work on behalf of the Karen Bass campaign that prevailed. Norman, let's talk about photographs in newspapers and what have you for a bit. There are a great many photos now in our newspapers. We're all familiar with the old saw that a picture is worth 1,000 words. I wonder, does that mainstream media follow that maxim in terms of where it might decide to place a picture of a candidate and what picture they use? Might it, for example, decide to use a picture of a candidate that they're not so excited about in front of a very small rally of his or her supporters and place a picture of the candidate they are in favor of speaking at a huge rally in front of his or her supporters?
The selectivity really does have an impact, often we might say subliminal, for the readers and viewers and so forth. And I think it's not always the case, but quite often a photo is depicted to be in sync with the spin of the article or the narrative. So if the article makes a candidate seem to be in an upbeat position and it's favorable, again, not always, but very often the photograph will be in sync with that theme. And unfortunately, also, there tends to be, in newspapers, a lot of synergy between the editorial pages and where the opinion is and the ostensibly objective front page and the news pages. Not always, but very, very often, you get a similar spin from both.
Norman, let's talk about the articles that the media prints or discusses on radio or TV and what effect they can have on which candidate is in the lead in the election they're reporting on. Do pollsters' reports showing one candidate ahead in the race have an impact on how a reader of the article might decide to vote, especially an undecided voter?
Often it's a spiral. When a candidate is reported to be gaining in the polls, then there's more news coverage. And when there's more news coverage, the candidate continues to gain in the polls. This, I think, is an example of the tremendous power that the editors and the journalists have in how and whether something is reported and the effect on the election. You know, and this is true in many ways, in addition to elections, that there's a sort of a pretense among journalism that, oh, gee, we're reporters. We just are like flies on the wall. Well, we're not just flies on the wall if we're reporting and we're from a major media outlet. We're actually affecting the events that we pretend that we're not having an effect on.
You know, I wonder, Norman, too, up until now we've been discussing largely the mainstream corporate media, print media and broadcast media. Let's take a look, though, at media on the Internet, where you're doing, I think, some wonderful work now, I might add, especially social media, and consider how it does or does not impact the outcome of elections in the United States. I mean, first, Norman, while those who participate in social media exchanges generally do not own the social media outlet that they're using, the outlet itself is generally owned, corporately owned, is it not? And it's the owner, for example, of that that determines what algorithms, how they're designed, what are used. So what role does social media play? Is it playing in our elections today?
Yeah, it's a great point you're making, because increasingly social media play very important roles in how information, misinformation, and disinformation gets distributed to people who do end up voting. And we should mention what is now called the Meta company, that formerly known as Facebook, and Facebook and Instagram, and these are reaching huge numbers of people. And while on the surface it is people communicating with people, in terms of volume and what is getting onto people's screen, to a large extent it's an algorithm that is constantly or frequently changing. And frankly, we often don't have a clue. Why is a certain image or article or essay getting on our screen? Well, it is because of these algorithm decisions that are made. And then we should ask ourselves, why are those decisions made? And there's a word for it. It's profits, or two words, corporate profits. Really, in a nutshell, a huge part of what afflicts our country in terms of media and communications, mass communications, because it's based on corporate profit. It's based on capitalism that says the more we can make profits for already rich people, the better. The more we can boost the bank accounts of investors, the better we're doing. And so all the rhetoric aside, the boards of directors of the corporations that I was mentioning a few minutes ago, board directors of Meta, these people who are hailed as great geniuses, as venture capitalists, they're just into getting more and more money. And the malign effects, the kind of vicious, often racist and misogynistic materials that are put out for millions of people to see and hear every day, that's not really their concern. The only concern around that tends to be, and we're seeing this with Twitter now and Elon Musk being the owner, is it might drive away some advertisers. Well, it's not really a solution to have the market determine this. We have a First Amendment, and we all have the right to be heard, not to be drowned out by big money.
So, Norman, what's the answer? What should or can be done to level the playing field where the media's influence on our elections is so concerning? After all, we claim to have a free press in America. Ought we not be careful when we speak of tampering with the media's role in our elections? After all, even if we limit the amount of money a candidate could spend in an election, as we've shown today, the corporate media can influence the outcome of the elections. Isn't that true?
Yeah, there are tremendous challenges involved and sometimes some dilemmas. If some people have a big megaphone and other people can't be heard at all, then that is not a society that really encourages the open use of the First Amendment or anything near equality. I mean, in theory, you could have free speech if you were put in solitary confinement in a prison, and you would be free to talk to the walls. And yet somebody else who's a Jeff Bezos or a Rupert Murdoch, they're heard by hundreds of millions of people. So there's something wrong with this model, and I'd say ultimately the problem is political power, because the way that the economy is structured has everything to do with who can be heard and who can't be heard. So in a nutshell, if we want to have authentic democracy, we need to define ways that people can be heard, not because of their wealth, but because they're part of the country.
I can remember some years ago interviewing you and Jeff Cohn at that time. I was expressing my old guy's chagrin about the fact that people weren't reading their newspapers in the morning. There was a proliferation of all these social media outlets and internet outlets, and who knows what people were reading and who was controlling it, and half the time you didn't know, and so forth. But is that nevertheless still a place where there is more of an equal opportunity for the person to compete with the voice of the big corporation, or not?
Well, I would say that when you get to traditional media, the disadvantages that low-income people and those who have the least power in the society, those disadvantages remain. And I think there are similar disadvantages in terms of seeing the internet and digital communications as mass media. Those disadvantages also exist. It's very capital intensive. Somebody can come in with a few hundred million dollars and they can create a news website that nobody's heard of, and within a matter of months, not only are they reaching millions of people online, but they're invited onto the corporate networks because they're important. You know, Axios or HuffPost or whatever, there was a time when those didn't exist. But because they exist, because huge money was put behind, then they're able to project messages and leave out messages through their own communications, and then there's sort of one hand washing the other. They can get into other media as well as so-called experts and promoting their journalists and commentators from their point of view. So I think that ultimately we have to democratize media, and that's going to be a big challenge. It's a political battle that has to be fought in state legislatures as well as in the Congress and in the entire political system.
Well, Norman Solomon, this has been really enlightening, and we thank you so much for being with us today. How can our listeners follow your work, find out more about your thinking, read that which you are putting on the internet and so forth?
Well, thanks a lot. I'm really glad to be part of this discussion on Law and Disorder. I'm at normansolomon.com, and I also want to invite people to read and sign up at rootsaction.org, because at Roots Action, we're very active in trying to address some of these imbalances of political and social power that have such consequences.
Terrific, terrific. Thank you so much.
Norman, keep causing trouble. Glad to have you on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Oh, thanks. You too. Both of you, thank you.
Last month, several Los Angeles City Council members were caught making racist remarks about black and brown people. To demonstrate the depths of racism in American society, this city council politicians, including one union head, were themselves people of color. Our Law and Disorder radio friend, Raymond Nat Turner, known as the People's Poet for his political activity at Los Angeles City College during the 60s radicalization, wrote the following about this incident. Raymond Nat Turner is a former forklift driver, warehouse worker, janitor. He lives in New York City, where he is a Black Agenda Report poet in residence and co-founder, co-leader of The Resistance and co-founder, co-leader of the jazz poetry ensemble Upsurge New York City.
We were L.A. way before they. Quote, ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have, unquote. James Baldwin. Venom-drenched recorded conversation of Rattler City Council criminals with labor serpent fluent in forked tongue, poisoned the smog, city of angels ruled by devils. Not our Chicano moratorium, mecha memories of the way we were. Could it be that class struggle was so simple then? We were Black and brown poets named Miles, Miguel, Alejandro, Raymond, named Guzman, Proctor, Mugia, Turner, burnished by the breakaway sun and singing songs of solidarity. We were Black and brown poets walking vertically, wearing oneness on our sleeves. Standing shoulder to shoulder in struggle, filling Compton and L.A. libraries and stages with four-alarm fire. We were L.A. way before they. We were Black and brown poets carrying compasses. Southeast L.A., we celebrated piping hot pinto beans, juicy collard greens, handmade tortillas, buttery cornbread, jazz, wine, weed, and mariachi. We celebrated boycotted grapes, brazen black cats, brown berets, and commemorated martyrs. We were L.A. way before they. We were Black and brown poets. Sankofa birds flocking, flying forward faster, resisting Pentagon with the wind, sausage machine in Southeast Asia gobbling up, grinding down steel squads of ghetto barrio warriors suited for service on the home front. We were red car babies with complicated handshakes and embraces, way before black faces in high places, way before brown faces in high places, that white supremacy places making salt of the earth expendable. We were L.A. way before they. We were Black and brown poets before cesspool plotters, planners backed by bloody badged bandito executioner muscle, arresting dreams in tarp, tent, cardboard mattress, skid rows. Before Huxtables looking down Pinocchio noses at calloused hands, blistered feet of lunch bucket brigades. Before battery-operated, self-serving, corporate-controlled ethnic cleansers, treacherous white supremacist strongmen, women with worldwide networks. Yes, we were L.A. way before they. We were L.A. way before they.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.